We are not heroes, nor are we villains, neither kings nor magicians, but we can tell you their stories. We are the Lore Keepers, and we welcome you to Hallowmay.
Welcome to Hallowmay. This is Lore Keepers, The Boundless Venture, the world-renowned podcasting opus, wherein the richest tapestry of lore in human history is sung into being before your very ear holes. I'm Frank.
And I'm Carter.
Whether you melt jewelry in volcano... Is this the same? Is this the right one?
You're doing the old one.
Oh, wow. Never mind. Yeah, I was like, the thing about human history, I was like, I don't, have we been saying that?
Yeah, we shortened it. We made it sexy.
I still think it's possibly true, like legitimately. Well, there's people, I mean, I don't know, Tolkien probably, we're in process, right? You know, imagine if Tolkien never had to release a book and was just allowed to nerd out forever, which he already did.
He did, yeah, he just did it in his private time.
Also, this couldn't exist without Tolkien, so, you know, shoulders of giants, etc. Anyways,
but Tolkien couldn't have existed without Francis T. Kettledorp.
God, yeah, wow, what a, that's a pull. Fucking Francis T. Kettledorp. Haven't thought about him in forever. This season, our focus is on gods, faith, and the relationship between mortals and immortals. So sit back, close your eyes, and let our tingling audio gateway sweep you into the realms of Hallowmay.
So this week, we're continuing our discussion of the afterlife from last week. But, you know, we may pick up some threads from last week. We may spin some new threads. We're feeling a little juicy. I have some hot matcha lemonade, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, full disclosure, the last episode we recorded, you're hearing it last week, but it's been a couple of weeks since we talked. This is like over Thanksgiving break and stuff, and now it's the weekend after that. And so we might not, it's a little bit blurry in my mind what we talked about. So some of that might come through rediscovery or whatever, but, you know, bear with us. I think we'll probably, it was all relatively incomplete underpinnings as it was last episode anyway, so whatever we pick up from that, you know, we pick up, and if we don't, we don't. But yeah, like, so last week, some of the stuff that we were talking about, we were basically focused on the afterlife. I mean, this is what Carter said, but like specifically some of the attributes of it, or the things within Hallowmay that we talked about was like, what does the afterlife mean for different people? Where, like, when people go to the Aetherium, what becomes of them? Do they like last forever? Is it something else? There is the aspect of the fact that the Aetherium was never actually meant to be an afterlife. Like, there was never meant to be an afterlife at all because people weren't meant to die originally. And so then, you know, how does that change the structures of things? And one of the big things that we were really focused on was the Moon Sisters, Hadariel, Gamaliel, and Mayon, and also technically Fenislil. And the role that they play as both divinities of some kind and also like literally physical objects, right? There is they have tidal force. You know, they're very, very physical. And so how does that work? Like, what is the interaction between those two? And I think at least if there's nothing else that was a nugget to extract from the last episode, I do think that the idea that, well, of course, other planetoids within the cosmos of Hallowmay, is it so strange that they would also have crystalline cores? Which then is like, oh, okay, maybe that's a structure, a manifold through which they have access to the abstracts, right? And so that makes them kind of a unique entity because, and this is maybe what the Shorn are, right? Is that they have a core that is necessarily, you know, yeah, like basically giving them a harmonic frequency with some dimension of the abstracts. And then as a result, they have an ability to kind of manifest that over the world. So a couple of things to start off here. Also, if we, you know, extrapolate this forward, it is curious to be like, what does that make Yadiel? Like, is Yadiel an entity of a different kind where it's more like the Animus as sort of having a passive ambient relationship to the Nine Flow instead of being like a god conscious in its own right? We talked about how Gaia basically became kind of a slumbering entity, and I think it's interesting that there's a relationship between Gaia and, you know, the Erebor. Like, right, like, was Erebor also a god of the Golden Hour? Yeah, and that is that what Sidar's, like, I don't know. That's, you know, that's also an interesting thing to explore. But in addition to that, obviously, you know, kind of getting back up to the surface level of things, the outcomes of all of this stuff, where does that leave us with the dead and what happens to the dead? How do we interweave the idea of physical ghosts and, you know, where, air quotes, if the Ethereum actually is topographically? Because it's not, you know, our ghosts are clearly being drawn towards the Fenisal Ocean, at least for the continent of Everast, the supercontinent. Or sorry, not the, you know, supercontinent is Umdara, but, you know, that ghosts are being drawn there. But then what happens to them, right? Are they ascending into the sky? Are they being drawn literally to the Moon Sisters? Is it something else? Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of different threads that we could grab here. We could also even just talk about the afterlives of the Ethereum or also Alluvium and what that implies for people. Carter, is there anything that, like, sticks out to you as something that you want to begin with?
I think retreading a little old ground might be helpful. So let's go back to what I said about physical ghosts in the previous episode. Right. So I wanted to draw a distinction between these spirits that we see or that we talk about and these ghosts that are more like monstrosities than whatever these spiritual things are. And so I made a kind of malformation. Yeah, so I made a division.
Like, you're not the way that a person's supposed to be.
I made a division between, like, spirited visits, when, like, a person who's dead, who's in, like, for example, the afterlife in the Ethereum, seeks the help of an angel to go down for a time to speak with or commune with, like, a relative or someone from their past life or whatever it is. And they might appear similar to how a ghost would appear. But that's not the same kind of thing that's happening because, right, this is angelic help. They're not actually physical in the same sense that these ghosts are.
It's more like an astral projection, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is one of those things I'm going to use from C.S. Lewis that I just love. Is in his space trilogy, and I've talked about this before, the idea that projections, like angels or other entities of sort of a spiritual nature, are not physically present. So what you see is you see them basically pushing on your neurons to simulate a person standing there, like to basically poke your brain in the places necessary to say person in front of you. And like, I just love that as a description also because in order to do that, they also appear that they're moving at a tremendous speed because they're not bound by gravity. So in order to, like, keep up with, like, the location that they're standing, they're basically all of their form looks like it's streaking behind them because it's following the rotation of the planet, which I think is really fun. And so maybe, you know, that's kind of how we describe some of the blur that's happening. But I would imagine that that's something similar with magic is happening with what you're saying is that visitation, you know, this is also maybe how you end up with a spirit who's not necessarily visible by everybody nearby. Maybe it's they're just trying to interact with one person versus they're sort of just sending out a field of anybody within this range, cast a spell that essentially tells Halume to poke all of the different buttons in their brain to say, we see this person. As though they were there.
Yeah, and so I wanted to then compare that with the what I consider these, like, ghostly monstrosities, things like ghostly undead, basically.
A banshee or whatever.
Banshees, specters, wraiths, all these different things. when they appear, so like their spirit, whatever like spirit is there, you know, I'm using spirit a bit loosely here. Their essence is present in the contour realm of Locus.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their like weird magical presence, because of how their essence affects a Locus, and Locus in turn affects the Materium, affects Sidar.
Right.
They appear as this like weird ectoplasmic plasmoid, whatever it is, like affectation. And so you can see them. They're visible to you because, and they're visible to anyone who can see, because what you're seeing isn't their essence. You're seeing the effect of their essence.
I mean, we could even say it's something like they're a void or a shadow cast. Oh, this is like mass shadows. Do you know about mass shadows?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, from Star Wars, basically the idea is hyperspace is not them traveling faster than life. It's an faster than light. It's them traveling through an alternate dimension that is like warp space or whatever, hyperspace. And so it's that physical objects cast a quote unquote mass shadow, which I think is such a cool idea, on that warp space, meaning that it affects like movement through it is affected by that shadow of mass. I think something kind of similar is happening with Locus, where it's like the imprint, clearly, okay, you know, unfinished business or whatever it is, not the ethereal realm, but like Locus, which I guess is kind of our ethereal realm, but I'm not going to get into that because we have the Ethereum. That's confusing. Locus, though, right? We've talked about it as a contour realm. It's sort of like a half step of frequency ranges between the Materium and, like, I guess the Ethereum or the ethereal, you know, like magical space. And so it sort of can affect both, and it's sometimes literally even visibly affecting if certain, you know, the equivalent of like a heat map, or, you know, you have an apparatus, whether it be biological or otherwise, that can see into it, right? Like when we talk about Bremen, which I suppose is coming up in the world of Halloween,
yep.
You know, Bremen, the Festival of Lights, this is from a long time ago, but the, you know, as a festival, one of the things that people do is that they literally kind of encode magic, or at least in relatively like wealthy places, like large cities or whatever, they encode magic so that a spire appears to give off. It makes the magical flows visible, basically, to the naked eye. It sort of tints them, if you will, it dyes them certain colors. And so people's actions literally like reverberate as a visible effect. And this doesn't last forever. It lasts for, you know, about a week or so, or a few days, or just one night, depending
on. And for like I think for like a real world example, for like how you could kind of think about this, imagine iron filings and magnetic fields.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing, what do they call it? It's QFT, quantum field theory. Basically, I didn't know this until recently. I fully caught up with the PBS Spacetime videos. Quantum field theory has basically replaced the standard model of quantum mechanics, or evolved it, if you will, in that, like, you know, once people really started to write shit down, like, you can describe the entire universe without using particles as objects, but just as relationships of information. And so there are some people who like think that information might be the fundamental object, like identity of things that exist, is its information interacting with each other. That's where people get the idea of like the universe could be a hologram, because you can describe everything that happens in the universe as stuff that is on a flat two-dimensional surface that is basically projecting it. Anyways, whatever. My point just being, fields. I think fields are a really good way of describing and understanding what's happening in Halloumet. You have fields of different powers and energies that happen with Locus. And so when a ghost, getting back to it, when a ghost exists, or there's some sort of spirit that has not, you know, has not moved on, I think it's almost like it casts this shadow Locus, where it's sort of maybe not a void, but it's a bending of Locus around it. and simultaneous, it's almost like a knot in the weave of Locus, where it's moving, it's interacting with the world, it maybe has some leftover business or some aspect of its previous identity, because there's, I think, still that interaction between the ghost and a tether to their spirit. Your spirit is that kernel that every living being gets, and then sort of the soul is like layers of personality built up around it. And after a person dies, what's supposed to happen is that that cord is snipped and the spirit and soul are allowed to go free, and the energies that tied them to the world, you know, sort of just float off and go back into the, not ecosystem, but I guess, like, you know, the meteorological, almost, you know, the arcane, the magigraphical system of Halume. And then that spirit is allowed to go free to the afterlife. And maybe what's happening is like, it's that the cord is partially cut, or there is something that goes wrong, kind of, where the person's dead, but like, because of the unfinished business or something, an aspect of that spirit and soul is hanging on. And however, because of that, they don't last forever, or they only manifest at certain times, right? They don't have energy that lasts forever. And the longer that that ghost is around, the less it'll look like an individual person, and the more it'll look almost like a riven, where there's nothing now to protect the shell of the spirit from all the different chaotic energies that are passing over the land. So any time that an itinerant, you know, flow of charity or ambition or whatever comes through, it's like it immediately hits that spirit, and then they're just filled with whatever that thing is. But if that lasts for 10 minutes or a couple hours and it goes away, they behave more and more chaotic as time goes on. So I guess what I'm trying to describe is a ghost that is around for, let's say, 10 years, right? I think that this behavior happens pretty slowly, because ghosts have almost a death cycle. It's not really a life cycle, but it basically, that spirit soul thing, the kernel with all of the little leaves around, early on after the death of a ghost, it might, you know, be very clearly like this person, and you have a strong sense of what they need or what they're looking for. But the longer that they go on with their unfinished business or whatever other malformation is allowing them to remain, the less they look like themselves and the more vulnerable they are to the itinerant flows. So, and like, this could be a really long time, right? It's more like it's less that there is just this ticking clock for everybody. And I think it depends on how much personality has built up, on what kind of person they were, what they're using their energy for. You know, yeah, it's not this like static thing for everybody. But it's just saying that, like, I think the forms, or what we recognize as different forms, may shift and change over time. And this might be how you end up with some of the more chaotic, like, I don't know if a ghoul is technically a specter.
Well, it's definitely, it's embodied. Ghouls are okay. Embodied.
Right. Well, and that's also the other kinds of like malformations that can happen is like, if necromancers or whatever are like reinserting this stuff into people, and then they're sort of like creating a shell around the personality to prevent it from ever like going away or something. You know, you can end up with some weird shit. Anyways, yeah, that was a lot.
Intelligent Undead I think its own episode. Because like at that point, sure. That's like, oof, that's hard to talk about.
Yeah. But I think, do you get what I'm trying to get at? Is like, yeah, the longer somebody is around, the less they are who they originally were, and the more they're just like a generic monstrous ghost.
Yeah, and I definitely think that there might be some divine protection for, you know, newly dead souls that are going towards where their afterlife is, right? Whatever mechanism that we eventually decide will take them to the afterlife, the Moon Sisters might play a role in that.
Yeah, I think, and what we could even say is that there is some level of, like, It almost like they're slowly crumbling away, or, you know, they're dropping these little leaves. If you have these shepherds who
Psychopompus.
Are, yeah, the Psychopompus, if they are you know, moving around, these angelic forces who are catching or noticing the trail that you leave, they might be able to reassemble the majority of it when you get to your afterlife or whatever, like when you get in front of the Moon Sisters. I think maybe what, you know, and I don't think, yeah, it goes away like right away. And also because I don't think that you're necessarily, it's usually like you're snagged on some level, right? Like there's something that happened that went wrong that didn't allow your spirit to leave properly. And so it's almost like maybe you have a, you know, ball and chain stuck to your leg and you're trying to drag that around. That's going to leave a much different imprint in Locus than a spirit that was cleanly cut and is allowed to sort of just flow right to, because then it's just floating along with the sort of the river of life or whatever. And it's not, the leaves aren't coming off of it because it's moving with it. Something like that.
Yes.
So, anyways, yeah, I don't think it's like a, the moment that you die, you start to lose everything that made you you, and the people who live very far away from Fenicil Ocean retain very little of their personality when they get to the Aetherium. I think it's more just like people can get lost, right?
Yes.
Even if they're not trying to, ghosts that are moving across the landscape or something. Yeah.
And I think you're right. There's probably angels who act as, right, soul leaders, psychopomps, mm-hmm. who try and collect these souls that are astray, get them to where they need to go. Because, you know, and I think that's just a duty of some, like, some non-embodied angels, right? They may not mm-hmm. need to be embodied for this kind of task.
Yeah, and, like, I think, you know, yeah, it's, like, more like they are, they might be quote unquote embodied, but not like embodied physically. They might be embodied within Locus. Whatever imprint or impact they have on Locus, they're sort of fishermen or shepherds or however you want to describe it. Like they're interacting with Locus because that's where the spirit is moving through.
Yeah. By embodied, I mean a physical rather than spiritual body.
And maybe like a wisp is sort of a malformed version of this free spirit or something, you know, like maybe most people, if you had true sight, you know, you can kind of see this ambient energies moving through the landscape or the occasional weave passing by. Kind of like, did you ever play Journey?
No.
Okay. It's not really a spoiler, but like at the end of the game, you kind of become this like star that arcs like a shooting star over the sky. And so when you're playing Journey, if you see a star like that, it means somebody has just completed the game. Which is a really cool, like, little trigger that you, like, watch kind of pass overhead and you can see. And so I imagine that in true sight, you know, maybe these people aren't moving directly over the ground. They might be, you know, it might be kind of anywhere, but there might just be these, like, weaves of energy that pass through. And they're basically spirits that are all moving towards Fenicil, the ocean. Or they might get caught up somewhere else. Which does mean that, like, you don't necessarily even have to be an angel to interact with them. I think this is where maybe some of that necromancy shit comes in. Is, like, you can catch those souls, or you could, you know, if you try to just stick your hand out, I think it just sort of flows around your hand or something.
Yeah.
If you're somehow able to interact with Locus that way. But there are, I'm sure, apparatuses?
No, I think it's apparatus. I think you're right.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a Latin word.
Yeah. It probably is. So that's a life cycle and death cycle with Umdara. Do we want to look at Orun as well, or do we want to reorient and look at other aspects of sort of that afterlife stuff?
You're kind of making me want to do an aside at necromancy.
Yeah, go for it. So, is there specific things that was on your mind?
I don't think most forms of undead are soul. I think most forms like zombies or skeletons are just basically constructs. They're just reanimations of bodies.
You know what? I agree, first of all. And second of all, I think this is where we see why Vivamancy or Zoemancy or whatever we called it, has this complicated past. Is I think necromancy, that Vivamancy or Zoemancy or whatever we called it, is the idea of like manipulating life energy versus like necromantic energy. Necromancy, I think originally the first necromancers were sort of interacting with both, And it was only later that it was split into understanding, like, okay, you know, the things that they're doing where they're putting somebody in a body or they're like reanimating a body, I think that's necromancy, right? That's like a false life or a life. It's like preventing something from actually like death interacting with that thing, right? Which, oh, that's interesting. I am curious to know what death thinks about that. I'm sure death doesn't like necromancy. I'm just,
yeah.
How does that work? And then I think it was maybe later that where people were lumping the people who did shit with ghosts and the people who did shit with zombies in with the same group. Well, because it's like, well, it's all death, right? And it's like, well, not exactly. Because the people who are doing stuff with life, they have to capture that in a different way. And so then later on, maybe this is an Avum Tertius or Avum Quartus or whatever, you know, as sort of the quote unquote sciences, you know, form these ideas a little bit more clearly, the two are separated into two distinct, related but distinct fields, kind of the same way that, like in the reverse of like electricity and magnetism, right? We know electromagnetism is now one force. There's a time when we thought of the two as separate.
Yes.
And maybe it's kind of a similar relationship with vivomancy and necromancy. But I agree with you. I think that I don't know what that energy is. Is it maybe just they're using the same kind of approach that an artificer would do to immaterial or like material objects, but with some biology or other stuff thrown in? And so it's just kind of like they're just impacting the form itself. Or it could be that they're interacting with anima. I think that's maybe where we've come to in the past, right?
Yeah, I think it's some weird relationship between using the nine flow to harness anima.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there was actually a really interesting realization I made recently. I don't know if I'll be able to extract it, but it basically had to do with anima and magic. Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, anima, basically, it interacts with the fundament. Magic interacts with the, you know, the nine flow or the like locus or whatever. Yeah. Anima, this is what it was. Yeah, basically that anima is if you have a program that you're writing, okay, out of code, oftentimes you use a library. You have like a library might be expressions, right? So if I'm writing in code, I use the if statement and then I have in parentheses and it does a thing, right? The computer uses a library of like, what does it mean when the person writes if, right? Or what does it mean when they say set this value to this other value, or what is true or false? You know, like there is a level of abstraction even when you're doing like hardcore coding, because it has to interpret into ones and zeros. And the library of like references that it uses for that, depending on your coding language, can change. So I had the idea of like, maybe this makes sense as a metaphor. Magic is like programming, right? You're using code and you're interacting with a library and you are changing what the code does.
Yeah.
Whatever we would call the thing where you're interacting with anima, which is like what a lot of Riven do and they become practitioners in, I think psionics are also like this. It's not interacting with the program, it's interacting with the library. And so it's not that you're changing, like, for instance, let's say that normally when you pour water out of a pitcher, it flows out and it goes down, right? Because it's like following gravity. You're not changing the program of the process of pouring the water out of the pitcher. If you're interacting with the fundament, what you're doing is you're changing how, like, what the law of gravity is. So then instead, when you pour water, it like goes up or, you know, just flows straight sideways or something. And you're doing it in like localized ways. And so I think that that's maybe necromancers, you know, and you can write codes that change libraries if you have backdoors to the library itself. And I think that's where you get some of sort of the back and forth between the two, mm-hmm, is somebody creates a backdoor and then they're able to interact with the magic behind it, or the like the code behind it. I think that's what, you know, necromancer who is working with dead bodies and manipulating their anima might be doing. Which is probably why it seems illicit, right? Is this idea of this is not natural, right? This is not the library of reality. Things like this shouldn't happen. It's one thing to be messing with a ghost because that's already part of the active environment. that's just changing programming that's sitting on top of it, but you're changing like the fundamental aspects of life by doing that.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
We also need to come up with a term for that. I don't know if there is like sort of a catch-all term for manipulating anima. I thought about animancy, but I'm pretty sure that's just
animals.
I don't think it can use the antsy because that suggests magic, right? As a suffix.
Can so, use thurge. I don't know. We can come up. Anathurge.
Yeah, you could do that. That's actually kind of fun. Or it'd be different kinds of urge, right? So there would be like, you know, chronothurge or yeah, something like that. We are close-ish in time. I did actually want to see if we could round out some stuff about the Moon Sisters. All right. I had some questions about. But before we do, was there anything else that you wanted to touch on or address?
I just wanted to quickly mention that, you know, talking a little bit about undead, a lot of this is different when it comes to like what Necromancer is doing with intelligent undead, because I think a lot of intelligent undead do have souls and are like weirdly corrupted in this weird way. So like a lot of the stuff we're talking about doesn't apply, I think, to the intelligent undead. And like even skeletons are technically intelligent undead because they have an int of like 6.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, and there's also scales too, right? Like they could have some vestiges or they could have like a spiritual kernel, or maybe there's some sort of, they're hooking into the oversoul type thing that we've talked about of like, you know, where Waldo do spirits Emerson? Come from? What'd you say?
Ralph Waldo Emerson's The Oversoul? Oh,
the guy who came up with The Oversoul? Yeah. Kind of. I mean, I know we've talked about where spirits come from, right? And that it's different, fundamentally different for the spiritual energies of the Aetherium than for the Materium. Like they're made out of different stuff.
Well, I think maybe not spiritual energies, but just like mortal and immortal souls is typically what we talk about there.
Yeah, I think that that's key, right? Like, yeah, because there's this kind of a battery versus a something plugged into a wall is, I think, kind of the way we've talked about it in the past, right? Like a deity or an angel oftentimes relies on active connection to the Aetherium.
Yeah.
And like, you know, if they get disconnected, it might not die immediately, depending on the thing, right? Some of them have like, you know, a power supply or whatever that can keep it going for a little bit, but they're not inherently like, yeah, they don't inherently have like a ticking clock that a mortal has. And most of them have pretty big spiritual batteries, if you will, but like, not all of them do.
Yeah, I would use maybe less like angels don't have batteries and mortals are batteries, and more like they're different kinds of batteries. And they're different shapes. So like, you know, there's the body, which is like, let's imagine like a toy soldier or something that uses batteries, and you use like double A's or something in that one. The angel is using like a fucking car battery. You can't hook
exactly
a car battery up to the fucking toy.
You'll blow it up. That's a really good metaphor. I actually really like that. There's like orders of what kind of, it's all electricity,
exactly,
but what is it being used for? And like, does the thing have the capacity for that kind of energy? And the angel might have to use an entire car battery or more just to get an imprint on reality, right? Because it's like, you know, the sieve is so fine, the mesh is so fine, or they can slip through, but you know, not a whole part of it. It might be almost like an amoeba that's sort of stuck in a bottleneck and a little bit of its butt is still hanging on one side and the other part's like bulged out. Like it might be something like that where like the little butt is the actual bit of the angel. I think that, you know, God, this is also why gods have so much trouble like actually manifesting physically. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I think I fully agree with that, that it is sort of this, there's this fundamental difference, but also necromantic objects, entities, there's like a sliding scale or a gradient of how much of their energies is involved.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you do your Moon Sister thing and then we can round it out.
Yeah. Well, basically, okay. So this was kind of floating in the back of my mind while we were talking about the Moon Sisters, but in the past, and I think we mentioned this last week, there's this idea of like, when you die, you go to the Moon Sisters, and then there's like cities on the moon, and then you're like divided into thirds depending on where you go. And we kind of talked about the idea of like, what if we reinterpret the way that the thirds is, and like the Moon Sisters have different roles.
Yeah.
So like one is the judge, one is the person who ferries, and one is something else. And I think we could do that. But I also am kind of not necessarily against the idea of keeping them in these thirds, because what it could be is that the, if you want to think about it from like a more sort of the objectively minded, the crystal cores of the different moons might resonate at three different frequency ranges, and the frequency ranges might be attuned to different chunks of the abstract, right? So you have like one that's connected to charity, ambition, and creativity, another that's connected to like wisdom, joy, and faith, and a third that's connected to peace, will, and perfection. And then, you know, depending on your own spiritual temperament, you almost are like drawn, like you were saying, like an iron filing to specifically one of them. And so there could almost be sort of like this, you know, this thin, I'm almost imagining a thin current, or like an electromagnetic current that's very narrow, like a tube, that all entities are drawn up through. And so like only spiritual, like spirits with their souls are actually big enough to get through, almost like a blood vessel or something. Or, and maybe it's not just one, maybe these are actually all over the ocean. Dude, and also sometimes the equivalent of like a spiritual tempest can occur. And so like something in the imbalance in the atmospheres can create like a vortex kind of connection, where like if you get too close to it, can literally suck your soul out of your body or some shit, like, or pull taut your relationship. So like you are having an out of body experience watching as your body just like slumps on it, or is just only running on its anima. And then like you have to work really hard, or like you can feel the thing coming tight. That could be pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking, where I was going with this, is like, I think that those streams, however we choose to do those, might gravitate towards one of the Moon Sisters. And when they move there, the imprint that it has in Locus and the imprint it has in the physical world is very different, right? Like when you look at a moon, are they verdant? They could even have life on them. Maybe. I'm actually kind of into that idea. At least one of them might have life on it. But I think for the most part, the Moon Sisters could easily be a barren rock, and it doesn't matter, because their imprint, their shadow, if you will, on the Locus is entirely different from what it is in the Materium, right? And so when people talk about these like cities on the moon or whatever, maybe it's not a city. Maybe what it is almost like the moon acts as like a focal gateway to a specific realm of one of these Moon Sisters that is just sort of this like demiplane, or, you know, small dimension where they sort of process and work through the different individuals. It's like sort of a rest stop for them before their final location. And so people talk about it like there must be cities on the moon, because spirits who have come back or whatever describe having that kind of experience.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're wrong. It's just that it's not happening in physical space. If you were to travel to one of the moons, you might see the weird flora fauna, you know, if there is any, or you might just, you know, be standing on a void rock. But in Locus, there is stuff there.
Yes.
And there, you know, as much as anything has like a strong location within Locus, I think that there is an associated tie. Maybe this is going to be a weird reference, but like in the same way that like, say you're playing American Truck Simulator and its relationship to the real world. This is playing on scale theory, the idea of what we see and what's actually happening aren't necessarily like intertwined perfectly. So like the distance, for instance, between two cities might be way, way shortened, you know, between like Chicago and New York in American Truck Simulator, because it's not going to be that long. But the relationships are the same, right? You might pass some of the same significant cities and stuff like that. And so a similar thing is happening in Locus, where it might not be that they're in the same quote unquote literal location, but the contour realm still behaves the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, last thing. This is actually, you know what? This is my lore bit. Do you have any lore bits?
Sure. I think I have one, but you go first.
Okay, my lore bit is this. Those little veins that like move through the astral sea, I think they're necessary. I think they're necessary because that is sort of a locus structure. Without it, I think the astral sea is like this either scouring or torrential void that can completely rip your spirit to shreds. If you were to like, you know, kind of drift outside of one of these veins or something, because the astral sea is unprismed magic. And it is like fucking, you know, it's just all of the like light energy that's passing through the, you know, the cosmos, the interplanetary medium. There's no curation of it. There's no sort of, you know, downshifting of it to an energy level that a person could actually experience. And so you just would get scoured. And so as they're rising up, there's sort of this like, you know, occasionally souls might get a little bit too close to the edge. And there's like angelic forces that are sort of like gently pushing them back towards the center to keep them from like tearing themselves apart or something.
I like it.
Part of the reason why I introduced that is the idea that like ghosts can't necessarily just fly wherever they want in the astral sea. There is like a ghosts very narrow space that they're allowed. Yeah, no ghosts on the moon. Well, I guess wizards, but no wizards on the moon. There are no wizards on the moon. Ghosts could be on the moon, sort of, but no wizards.
All right, Frank.
Well, I think that kind of resolves it. Yeah, what was your lore?
My lore bit's weird. You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
I think Yadiel has some weird liquid crystal shit going on.
Really?
Yep. Kind of like how Jupiter has like metallic hydrogen that's liquid that does shit and produces magnetic fields.
You're right.
I think there's some weird shit going on with Yadiel with regard to that. And like that's Yadiel's body or something like this.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, I think. Oh, go ahead.
And then this is the weird bit. I think nothing about. I don't think we've ever said this. So I want to change it. I want to make it different.
Okay.
I don't think the light from Yadiel is yellow.
Really?
I think it's white.
Wow, dude. So it's just like it's a bright white ball
in
the sky instead of being like a. And I mean, obviously, atmosphere can diffract that or whatever. We can still say it appears in ways that we want to see it or whatever. But like, I like that idea. It's like a. Would it be a white dwarf then?
I don't know.
Or you're just saying the star classification. Well, I don't know if those star classifications even make any sense.
Yeah, I don't know if that applies to the physics of this world.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's necessarily the same size as our sun. I think that it might. It could be roughly close to our solar mass, but like I don't even have a frame of reference for which I can even fathom scales that big. So it's kind of irrelevant to me.
It's bigger.
Yeah.
There you go.
I really like that, dude. That's super cool. This is what I was going to say is. I think I would. This is somewhere where I'd love to go with this later, but obviously we have to wrap up now. I'm so curious about like how, because the shorn, or at least are they shorn, right? Like, what do we call? I think they would still probably be shorn, but like they and the other planetary bodies, if they have crystal cores or if they have this crystalline like matrix of some sort of liquid, which by the way is basically already possible in our physical reality. Like for instance, neutron stars, I think they're so fucking dense that like. You basically get a static lattice work of atomic structure in their center that behaves. It's just crazy. It's like a really weird element or state of matter. You could totally have crystalline type liquids that are happening in the sun. Sure, why not? But I do think it's really, I'd be really curious to see how quote unquote conscious these gods are. Because I think that they might be fundamentally different in their nature.
I think they're more a force than being.
Mm-hmm. I think they still have some of that consciousness, but they might have already been more like a kind of a slumbering deity before the golden hour, right? Like somewhere in between a conscious acting character and an assembly of energies and intentions. They're not animus. They're not like fully comatose, like, in, you know, inert. They only interact with you when you interact with them, or maybe they occasionally wake up or are moving on this extremely slow timescale. But I do think that they're somewhere in between. And that's interesting to me. That's definitely an episode for later. But for now, we have to close things out.
Yep.
Thank you for ear seeing. If you were pleasured by what you heard, don't hesitate to share this with others. Feel free to rate or review us on the podcasting platform of your choice. And don't forget to ding that bell.
I guess we were capping off each episode with a reading from the Book of Truth, but I don't know if there's much left of that these days. I also have no idea if Twitter is still live.
Yeah, we need to change up
right
now.
We need
to read from the Book of Elam.
Yeah, so God.
It's a real musty tome.
You know what? Here, I'll throw this one out there. It would be you, but I did find a good one. No, you can take a look. If you don't want to look, I have one. But I was just going to say, with that in mind...
I also wanted to thank Josh Silker and Sam Lake.
Oh, yeah, no, don't worry. We'll get to all of that.
Well, you're skipping around, so, like, what the fuck are you doing?
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Thanks, as always, to Josh, the Silkman Silker, for the Land of Heroes theme. And thank you to Sam Wade for the album art. You can find Sam at By Sam Wade on Twitter and Instagram. Probably still on Twitter. I haven't checked. and you can also find the album art on Frank's body.
First of all, I don't actually know if you can reach us on Twitter anymore, because at the Lore Keepers, as of the last time I knew, was permanently suspended. Carter, did I tell you this?
Yeah, you told me about the Satine Phoenix thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Satire Phoenix. Gosh, I wish I had come up with that. That was so smart. But anyways, yeah, I don't know. I don't think we've been reinstated. I've been running stuff off of, I think, at 1,000 icons, or I'll put it in the description. If you are curious about where the new feed is, I'm still checking in occasionally and posting shit. I would like to get our old account back. That would be nice. But who even knows? Again, whether Twitter will be around by the time this episode comes out.
Yeah, he may sell it and reinvest in his the old emerald mine in Zambia.
Oh God, I know. Is it really?
No.
Yes. Yeah. Why would you? Oh, I was gonna say, why would you ever decommission an emerald mine unless it was out of emeralds?
Presumably, either that or some governmental apparatus made it not effective anymore.
Well, regardless, I was just gonna mention, this is my last thing, that we are obviously pretty high in the episode numbers for the season, and it's close to the end of the year. We thought it would be a good time to start to wrap up some of the God stuff, but we have so many things left to talk about with the gods, so why would we end the season? That seems like, you know, well, if we're still riding high on it. Well, here's the thing. We have thought about it, and we're thinking we're going to change the structure of things. Going forward, and I might still just put this under the next season structure, we're going to be tracking things by series instead of by season. So this next season will stay the same, but like each episode will have like a little, you know, little thing basically saying, here's what series number it is or something. And we're going to do things in slightly shorter chunks, but see what happens if we try and focus on just one thing for a few episodes and explore it from all the different angles. Now, this might still be like a 10 episode or 12 episode run. It really just depends on how much material we have. But this way we can jump around a little bit more. And as we have different and new ideas, you know, we can explore them as is instead of writing them down, being like, oh, we should return to this in 8 months. With that being said and in mind, if you have any ideas for series that you would like to see, feel free to reach out to us. I would say at this point, probably just send it to our email at lorekeeperspodcast@gmail.com instead of on the Twitter, because again, who even knows? But yeah, we will definitely take those into consideration when we're thinking about what series to do when. So anyways, do you want me to read this tweet or no? I think it might be good. All right. Sorry for chomping your styles there. As you chant, so I weave my voice. I craft my strings of fire. I fill the world with my own sweet sound. The stars themselves, the ends of the land, the wind, even the place where the light goes out, all bend to worship me.
And until next time, don't forget, there's always more spirits to collect.
More zombies to revivify. That's not the word. Whatever. Thanks, everyone. Bye. Bye. She, the first year that we had Maisie, she was able to climb up and into the tree, like, all the way up. And so we have pictures of her, like, peeking out from five feet up off the ground. But since then, she is definitely far too big. And, like, the bars hurt on her paws and stuff. So she's tried multiple times already, like, almost immediately. To climb, and she couldn't. So she settled for, like, hunching over the first set of bars as though she's kind of sitting on it, but not really.
Nice. It's
absurd. Yeah.
Yeah. I've already gotten a Christmas gift from my parents. They got me a TV. Nice.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Nice. You got a... They already told you what they got you?
Well, I mean, I already have it.
Oh, they already sent you the Christmas gift. Nice, very early Christmas gift.
And
how big is it?
It's 50 inch, 4K.
Nice. That is, I think it's bigger than we've got. That's for sure.
Yeah, I've had a 40 inch for a while, and they're like, mm-hmm. Basically, they gave away like a 60 inch 4K super nice TV, and I was like, I could have probably used that. And they're like, oh.
They gave it away, as in like gave it to somebody else?
Yeah, they have a friend who'd like just like. They're like, oh, you want this TV? Because we don't want to use it anymore. And their friend's like, yeah.
Yeah, when my folks moved into their newest place, they had, the people before them had installed a like 60 inch, or it was maybe even like, it was enormous. It was like, I mean, I don't know. My context is, I think we have a 43 inch, which is big to me, but like also it was... Like, it was an upgrade from the 32-inch that I had before, which I was basically just using as, like, kind of a nearby monitor.
Yeah,
like, I'd never sit more than a few feet away from it. So, yeah, I mean, it's literally, when I look at it now, I have 27-inch 4K on my desktop, and it's like, like, when I think about, I mean, because that's the thing, though, is I was, like, poor as shit when I first, but it was, you know, after I first got out of college, but it was this thought of, oh my God, I have money for the first time in my life because I'm making an income. I can buy things. So I like put together a whole, you know, my first gaming rig and stuff like that. And I got a 1080p, 32 inch or whatever. And then almost immediately, the way that I had it set up was I had the little feet and I had the TV and it was sitting on top of a spot that was barely big enough for where all the feet were. So like it was this cabinet that I think I jostled once about 5 or 6 months in, and the whole TV just dropped down, smacked its face, and immediately like broke the pixels. I of course didn't have any insurance for it, so
yeah.
I went back and asked them, yeah, like, so is there any way? And they're like, yeah, no, we're not gonna cover this under warranty. And so that day I learned the value of getting insurance on any big items like that, because again, it was fairly expensive for me at the time, and fucking mounting shit. I mount everything now. Everything is mounted to a wall because you can't knock that down.
Or just appropriately sized tables.
Or I guess don't use a table where there's like this much extra space on the legs on both sides and also on the front to back, and the legs only touch the ground in like two spots. Or four spots, like, total. So, yeah, not a great choice. But, yeah, no, and then I got a 43-inch from my roommate who just didn't want it in his room anymore and didn't use it very much. And then that's the same one that we've had to this day. And I've been talking to Rachel about eventually upgrading it, but, like, neither of us really feels a push yet. Partially because it's, like, if I am going to upgrade, I'm kind of thinking, like, get like a really big TV, but also then it's like, oh, but maybe I should do 4K. But then also because of the Plex, I'm just like, I don't know if I actually do want to upgrade things to 4K because I'm not sure how they're going to render. I'm probably not going to upscale most of the library.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'm not going to upgrade because then those files get to be like, it's like 8 gigs for a movie, which I have a lot of space. Like we have a lot of space on the Plex. I'm not really worried about that, but
if every
I also
movie
would have to re-download everything. Yeah, exactly. Like an hour long TV show is like 4 gigs now.
Yeah.
And it's like, and also streaming that to people, right? Cause then they have to stream 4 gigs, which I have fiber. So it's not really an issue, but there's no guarantee I'm going to have fiber forever.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of like a, I don't know, up in the air. Maybe if I didn't have this server, then it would be a different situation. But you're going to have to tell me how things look on your TV. Have you already started using it with the Plex at all?
No, because I haven't. So my table currently is not big enough for the TV. So my parents also bought me a table.
So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
But Frank, I measured it. And I was like, this TV will not fit. And then they're like, oh, we'll just buy you a table. And so I have not tried to put my 50-inch on a tiny table.
Well, bless you and your parents with their reliable incomes, man. That's awesome.
True.
I'm happy for you.
And I've also already gotten a Christmas gift to myself, though I've sent it
to
my winter residence in Florida.
Your home away from, well, your home that's maybe, well, I don't know at this point what you consider your home. But you sent it there because you're going to be there for over the break.
Yeah, it's very doable. So basically, and this is one of the reasons why I'm bringing my equipment.
Throw your PC in the car.
Yeah. I've got a bag for it. What I bought myself, Frank, is a massive amount of PC parts. The rig. I'm making an entirely new rig.
Oh, really? You're starting from scratch.
New case. New motherboard, new CPU, new PSU.
There's never a better time than Cyber Monday shit, my dude, you know?
Yep. I got that's what we
I did that 2 years in a row, I realize now. Like, literally for, not this last year, but the year before that, which it's amazing to think that this PC that I'm, that I use every day is like 2 years old because, I mean, it still feels top of the line. Which, I mean, it should because it's a PC, but like, I don't know. They, you know, they almost immediately came out with the 40, whatever, 47, 40, 80, 40, 90 cards. And it's just like, I don't even know if video games can really take advantage of all of that power at this point.
It's also like, have you seen all the problems they've been having with 4080s?
Oh, they've been having problems?
They've been melting their like fucking plugs and shit.
Yeah. Because there's so much heat passing through?
Apparently.
Holy shit. That's probably not good.
People have these, like, you know, like 8 or 12 pin or 16 pin power connectors, and they're just melting.
That makes me think of, I don't remember what game this is, but there's a game where you are, to repair stuff, you're like, pulling out a chip, and it's maybe, like, it's a reload for a gun or something. And the whole chip just looks like fried, like there's just like melted chunks coming off of it or whatever. And then you stick in a new one. I don't remember. It's just a weird thing that rose out of my memory. Did you get yourself a 4080?
No.
I'm sure you were doing your research to figure this shit out.
I got a 3070 Ti.
Nice. I mean, dude, I have a 3070 and it's a really good card. You are not going to have any problems with
it. I did my research and I was like, I was between the 30. So first I was doing the 3060 and I'm like, I feel like, you know, I've got a bit of money saved up. Like, I can afford to go up a little bit. And so I'm like, okay, between the 3070 and the 3080 Ti, like, looking at the TIs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, the 3070 Ti is really good. It's got a lot of benchmark stats. A lot of people are using it. And I look at the 3080 and I'm like, okay, 3080 is twice as expensive and only 40% better. Going with the 3070.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, I think I've only ever used... Well, I've only ever had two generations of card. I think I had the 1070, and then I now have the 3070, and I think that the 70s usually are totally fine. Like I was running before I rebuilt, I was running Watch Dogs 2, which admittedly is a game that came out in, like, I think 2016 or 2017 or something. It's pretty old, but, like, this was a couple of years ago, so it was a little bit, new, you know, closer to then. But it was, like, a five-year-old game or something. But also, like, I was running it on 4K. I was running it with, like, max density of everything, and I was running it, like, you know, with all of the highest settings turned up, and it was fine. Like, it ran without any issue. I don't know. I think for the most part, especially when they have the, oh, I don't remember what it's called, but it's that thing that NVIDIA has been doing, the GeForce. Is it GeForce Now or whatever? It's like the
GeForce Experience, ray tracing thing. Whatever. Or do you mean the streaming
Well, not
thing?
That. It's like the specific thing that you can turn on for some games where it, like, scales up stuff by calculating. It's like straight up computer magic. It figures out what that should be, and so it uses a much a smaller rendering window of, like, what the actual pixels are, and then it calculates them in live time, like how to interlace it between it and the pixel next to it to create an additional pixel. So basically you're getting a 4K, an almost 4K resolution, but your computer only has to render like 1080p. It's insane. Like, it's really crazy. I can't remember what this is. Oh, DLSS, the dynamic something super sampling.
Oh, yes. DLSS rendering. Okay.
Yeah, it's straight up magic. Like, it's such a smart way to do technology because, like, yeah, literally, like, the loads on my stuff would bottom out, and it was almost an identical level of quality. And then sometimes it actually looked better than original 4K because it was less chuggy. Like, I was using it for No Man's Sky, and you, as a result, like, that game actually already is pretty really well optimized, but, like, it was like hyper sampling, dude. It was your terrain mixes and all of that stuff, the populations of creatures and things, you could extend to the max settings, and, like, everything was gorgeous. And, like, there was a moment where if you had, like, if you stopped moving, where there was, like, of the blink of an eye where things would just be a little bit blurry because it takes the first frame and interpolates it with the next frame and the next. And so it sort of, like, builds it progressively as you stop moving. But, like, nothing ever felt blurry. It's pretty cool. You should definitely check it out when you get your new card. Are you going to build it for Christmas, or are you going to do it right now?
I'm building it for Christmas, yeah, because all the stuff is in my winter residence, right, when I leave.
Oh,
there.
That's right.
Once you I get you there, it, like, you know, delivered in a week it to Florida. Or so, I'll build it then.
Sure. Yeah. That's great, dude. That'll be a lot of fun. I mean, but yeah, that's what I did a couple of years ago. That's what we did, I think, last year. I would just, because we built a second PC for the TV. And, like, literally, I think that what I did is I literally just, like, after I bought the thing, I'd wrap it up and stick it under the tree, even though I knew what it was. Yeah. And I was going to be the one opening it, mostly just because I like having a bunch of presents under the tree. And so the soft rule, the tradition that Rachel and I have created, is that if there's anything that we don't explicitly need right away after black or like after Thanksgiving, but before Christmas, if it's a thing we're buying, like, for the house, like, let's say it's new pot holders or whatever, we'll just wrap whatever that thing is and stick it under the tree and open all it at once. It's a good time.
Groceries. Like, oh, that's cheese.
A bunch of cheese that's just gone just completely sideways. I think she might be getting me a box of Milka bars for Christmas.
All right.
I had Milka when we were over in, it's like I think a Swiss chocolate or German chocolate. It's not like the most amazing brand. I think probably like Godiva is probably better.
If you want Swiss, Frank, you got to go for Toblerone.
I feel like.
You don't like the honey almond Milka nougat?
No, I really do like Toblerone, but I think that Milka is actually a higher quality chocolate than that. Like, honestly, it's just kind of amazing. And there's definitely better brands, but I became addicted to Milka bars when I was overseas, and they don't sell them here, or they kind of do, but they're an import, so it's much more expensive. Ooh, yeah. And so the only way to get them is to, like, buy them in bulk. But I also was like, I want 300 gram bars. They had, like, bars that were, like, this big, and it was like some shit out of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But I don't think that you can really get those.
Imagine you in, like, fucking the streets of Rome with just, like, two Milka bars.
I mean, like, that was basically what I was doing when I I was like Augustus Gloop. And there's just like chocolate just dripping all over my face.
You get your American flag backpack and you're like pointing at the Colosseum. Look at that big stadium. Eating your Malka bar.
You could put so much NASCAR in there.
Do the Bulls know how to turn left?
Yeah, the Bulls in the Colosseum. Well, yep. I guess there would have been, but yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Oh man, dude, I like, we should pick what we're going to do, but I have been in such a different mindset for the last week and a half. I decided to finally pull the trigger on, I think I maybe mentioned this forever ago, but like AppSheets. Does that sound familiar?
AppSheets? No.
It's like a low coding program or platform. The way it works is you do low to no coding, basically. Okay. If you know how to use like Excel or Google Sheets, it's basically like really beautified data, like YASified data entry. Basically, the way it works is it works on top of, you can make it work with Excel, but I would just use Google Sheets. And that's what I use. Because that's what I use for everything. But it basically, yeah, sits on top, and then you give information like records or what are they called in the world? A tuple. You ever heard that word before?
No.
A tuple is, or a tuple, I think maybe, is just like a row of information. And so it's like you have an object ID, right? Where it's like, this is a piece of, you know, this is a reference for whatever this information is. And then it has attributes. And the way that this is manifested is like you have a row with columns, right? So you'd have, you know, this is how a lot of like data works, apparently, is that you just have like, here's a thing that the computer can reference, you know, like a tag. And then you have a bunch of columns of like, here's all the attributes that are associated with it. Anyways, I'm not going to, you know, this is so fucking boring here. But basically, like, there's a couple of programs that I've been meaning to like build. And the first of them is like a kind of that marks system that I was talking about. It's been good, but it's also been frustrating to like have to do, like I've been getting tired of putting it into Google Sheets and having to type everything out manually. And it's like pretty automatic as is. And I like using Google Sheets for a lot of data. Like I do a lot of data shit that makes me, I know, a big, enormous bootied nerd. But it's, what's good about AppSheets is that all of that stuff then lives in the cloud, but there's like an app that you just log into on your phone and then you have access to whatever that is. And so it has really good UX. Like you can actually like create buttons and actions and all of that stuff to make it so that like the data that you're interacting with is like well organized and designed. And there's so many things like this. Like I was even just thinking like, oh man, it is annoying that Google Maps, I have to like tap so many times to get to like save locations. So for instance, I would like to be able to just save the information of when is it open or not? And like, what's their phone number if I need to call them for something, or, you know, maybe there's a gas station and I just need to know, like, you know, route me to this thing. And instead of having to type out the thing or go to my save locations or whatever, I was just thinking how nice it would be if I could just open an app and then it immediately has specifically the actions that I have. And so the thing is it's like AppSheets is made for enterprise stuff, but I've gotten to the point in my life where I'm so picky with the way that I want to interact with my data. And oftentimes there aren't real solutions for it, for stuff beyond just like grit your teeth and bear it. And so this is like a fantastic middle ground where there are some kinds of data where it's like, well, it's not a big thing and most people aren't going to want to use this. But there is a use case for me that would just make the thing I want to do so much easier and faster. And so I'm not good at programming, and also being good at programming does not necessarily mean you're good at building apps, because apps require that user interface, right? The way that you interact with data is a huge part of, you know, it's not just an aesthetic thing, because like, you know, when you're scrolling through an app, how many apps get dumped because it's just like, this is so much to work through.
Yeah, it needs
so
to be
I have the ability.
Not nearly. Mm-hmm,
exactly. Like, I actually recently switched off of using Apple Music. Not the service. I still subscribe and I still use Apple's music, but I don't use the app anymore. Because there I found a much better front end that, like, it's a custom app that somebody created that allows you to have a tremendous amount of depth and ability to, like, interact with stuff. And I don't know if there's equivalents for Spotify. There might be, but, like, the ability to just, like, what does my home screen look like? And like, what do I want to see my information? What kind of playlist do I actually want to see? Instead of just having to scroll through one single list, or, like, there's folders within folders, but it's all ugly and it's really space wasty. And, like, that kind of thing, right? I now listen to so much more music than I was, and the, like, the amount, the kinds of music, like, it's completely reinvigorated my experience. And so there's just, like, a bunch of different use cases for developing applets that, you know, nobody else would ever use, but is useful for me. So anyways, that's where my brain has been for the last, like, week and a half. I completely set down the timeline, because I'm just like, I just need to finish this. And if I try and, like, do an hour and a half every couple of days, I'm never going to get it done. That's how I got to this point as is. So I just need to knock this out. And I'm actually pretty close now. Like, I've made a ton of progress. But then I'm going to jump back into the timeline. Got a couple thousand years of history left before I'm ready to do the, you know, the current events.
Yeah, Frank, but you're reminding me a lot of Michael with, you know how he's building his character sheets in Roll 20 for Imagine?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I think he's done. I think it's like
he finished it.
I think it's like over 50,000 lines of code. Yeah, it's absurd.
Oh my god!
But yeah, that's actual, like, fucking dirty coding that he had to teach himself, had to do in their API, and it's just like,
yeah. Oh, I can't imagine Roll 20 is built well as a platform structure.
But, like, I
maybe
think
maybe it is. Maybe it's really clean and nice to code. But
I think he's currently kind of like dicking around with how equipment works. So basically, mm-hmm. it's not just like, oh, it's loose equipment stuff. He has three different modes for equipment. There's, like, strict body location equipment. There's, like, mm-hmm. equipped or not equipped. And then there's just loose, where it's like, okay, well, you just have this equipment. Or you can do the, like, okay, well, this is the stuff that you are wearing, and this is stuff you're not wearing. And then it's like, you're wearing this on your hip, and, like, you're wearing this on your back, and as... And this is in this bag.
Michael's system is so interesting to me because on the one hand, it is the complete antithesis of what I want out of an RPG. And yet the way that we were playing and the way that, like, combat works and stuff, it actually is, like, pretty fluid and is not, it's not bad. Like, it's the second by second transpiring of how you swing and stuff very much is reminiscent to me of the best parts of, like, in, like, surprisingly, Aragorn's combat is Paolini does an extremely good job of describing every sword swing. Like, there are sometimes pages where, like, you feel like you're actually watching a sword fight, and I can totally visualize that. And that's as a person who doesn't actually have the ability to visualize. And I feel like Michael's combat does that in a way that I haven't seen any other fantasy setting actually do, which is that fight scenes are pretty... I'm sure that there are things that, like, actually articulate this well, but, like, for instance, the combat situations, or at least high-intensity action scenes in Wheel of Time, for example, are, like, nigh illegible. Like, I don't really know what's happening at any specific moment because there's no sense of space. And because also
Rand's just like, I gotta sheath the sword, he's coming at
yeah
me.
And he dives forward, and it's like like, physically, or, like, did he bring his arms down, or, like, you know? And Paolini, as a kid writing Aragorn, did such a good job of describing it, but in a way that didn't feel like, it was riveting, you know, yeah, second by second watching. And Michael's system does a really good job of that. If I will say, I don't know how it plays without all of the formulas, though. You know, like, it's interesting. This is something I've been thinking about for a while now, where I don't really want to design a game that requires algorithms and stuff, but I want to design a system that can make good use of them.
Yeah.
Because these days, whether you're at a table with other people or playing online, we've all got computers that are orders of magnitude, literally like 10 or 100,000 times more powerful than what it took to get the astronauts to the moon. And it's really easy to just have it just pop out some computations to, you know, catch what's happening in a moment. And it, I don't want, you know, I that is not only the current state of play, but it's also just like, to not use those resources would be to kind of not be acknowledging where things were at. And also, if it could make the game better, why not use it?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting balance that my other project that I set down a while ago for, you know, building up the background of this campaign that I will be resuming, Work to Eat, that I haven't forgotten about it. I'm still, you know, it's still on my mind. I just set it down and I just pick things up in enormous cycles. You know me. But anyways.
I mean, surely, Frank, we should be looking to end the season, right?
Oh, I suppose so. I mean, especially because it's towards the end of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we're going to end the season right at the end of the year, though, because, like, I feel like there's too many things that I want to keep pulling on.
Okay.
And we don't necessarily have to
end the season of Gods. And
are you?
No, not necessarily. I'm good either way.
It's
but
okay if you were. Like, I mean, there's plenty of other stuff to talk about, too. I just, like, I'm having fun where we're at, and there's still so much to do.
Yeah, I mean, I just,
we could always come back to it, too.
Yeah,
maybe
of
people
course
are getting tired of it.
I was just under the assumption that, I suppose, we've been doing this season for a long time. Should we end it, is the idea. But
that's a good point. I think maybe we do. We can start thinking about ideas for what we want for the next season, and we can always come back to Gods, too. And other seasons can also be shorter, too. Like, you know, they could be, like, this one has been by far, I think, the longest season that we've done.
And, I mean, right, other seasons can still heavily feature Gods. It's just, like, this one has been just about them.
Or maybe what we do is, instead of a season, we have, like, series.
Yeah.
Right? So we say, that could actually be the thing that we try. And because so then it's like, if we're not into it or whatever, well, it might only be like 7 or 8 episodes plus before we move on to something else. That's actually not a bad idea of a structure to try for next year. Maybe we do that.
All right.
Because then we can say, hey, we're focusing on this god, or we had this really good idea about a land or something. And so we're going to, you know, we're wrapping up this other thing. And then, you know, here's what we're going to be diving into. Let's do that. Because that's what I liked about the Mutes.
Make a note, Frank.
Yeah.
I'm not talking to you.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You. Hey, stop. Slow. No, turn off the high speed. Stop editing at high speed and write that down. Did you finish it? Well, wait. Okay.
Yeah. Look away from RuneScape for a second. Jeez.
I actually haven't picked it up in a couple of, like, a month or so. Like, I've been logging in for, like, daily stuff, but just barely.
I haven't touched it. Well, I mean, I've been logging in every day, but
for a minute and a half, basically just daily resources that I've been getting. Mostly just because I'm at, like, a spot where I need to invest about 2 hours of solid play to, like, proceed on this quest, and I just, like, it's the longest quest in the game. It's Sliskay's endgame. It's literally, I think, like, 3.5 hours long or something.
Wow.
And so I'm just, which I probably doesn't sound like much, but, like, think if, like, a World of Warcraft quest took, I don't even know. I guess maybe they take that. I don't know. Anyways.
Well, they take 3 hours because you get on your horse and you go to a different area or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get fucking gonked by some dudes.